This is Contemplative Revolution, a WCCM podcast. I'm Elba Rodriguez. In this episode, Father Lawrence Freeman discusses the evolution of our relationship to Jesus as our teacher and the challenges of discipleship. This dialogue session between Father Lawrence and His Holiness the Dalai Lama was held at Sarnath, India.
I would begin by speaking personally, really, about Jesus, how I see and understand and relate to the person of Jesus as my teacher, and then His Holiness will respond and speak about the Buddha in the same way from his own personal perspective, and maybe we will talk about some of the philosophical or theological ideas of Jesus and the Buddha as well. But primarily, I think, just speak about it as how we see it personally. The first level of my understanding, my relationship to Jesus, is at the human level, simple human level. He was a historical teacher. Although many ideas and legends have accumulated around him, we know from the Gospels that he was born in a particular place, in a particular time, and he belonged to a particular culture and grew up within that religious and social and political world. So I approach Jesus at this human level. I relate to him, first of all, as a natural Jesus, not supernatural. Extraordinary human being, quite clearly, and one of the very few human beings who has been born, who has become a universal teacher, who can be respected and loved by any intelligent person of goodwill in any tradition or in any period of time. So extraordinary, but not supernatural in that sense. In fact, I must say, the longer I have been meditating, the less interested I am in the supernatural. The supernatural is not a useful category. I think nature is full of mysteries that we cannot explain, just as the universe itself contains many scientific problems that we cannot understand or explain yet. The whole of existence is mysterious, but it's natural. So I think the first level of relationship to Jesus is in this world of nature. We know little about his early life. The first 30 years of his life is very hidden. But then we know that he had an awakening, a spiritual awakening, which is symbolized in the story of the baptism when he was baptized by John the Baptist. And immediately after his baptism, in the Gospels it says, the Spirit led him into the desert, and he spent 40 days of spiritual practice, fasting and prayer and solitude in the desert. And I think we can see this as an enlightenment experience, just as monks in all traditions, lay people in all traditions, set a time, special periods and special practices in order to develop their spiritual journey. The point is, I think, that we can identify with Jesus not only in terms of human, social, psychological development, but also his spiritual journey. We can recognize in him the stages of personal development. We can see that his identity was constructed, as it is in all of us, through our early experiences and through our culture. But also, what I see in him is the ability to transcend that conditioning. And it's a lesson to me that although I have a particular culture, a particular religion, a particular frame of reference, I must also transcend that conditioning in the same way as Your Holiness just said. We relate to each other at the deepest level simply as human beings. And that simple meeting as human beings is actually the goal. Because our conditioning is so strong, it's quite difficult for us to meet at that simple level. So Jesus for me is a teacher of the potential we have to transcend our conditioning, our culture, and to engage, meet with each other at the most simple and direct human level. He also is a teacher for me because he teaches by example, not simply by words or propositions or ideas. We see, however, in his teaching, his life. His life is consistent with his teaching. I remember I asked you, Your Holiness, many years ago, how you managed to keep calm and peaceful in your life with the many responsibilities you carry and your concern for Tibet and your responsibilities in the world. And your answer has always stayed with me. You said, I try to be the same when I'm on my own or when I'm with my close friends or colleagues or whether I'm in public in a big social event. And I think that is, for me, also the great attraction in the person of Jesus as we see him in the Gospels. He was a person of integrity, wholeness, who was himself. He wasn't playing a role or pretending to be something. He was simply himself. It was this authority that impressed his contemporaries, but also often angered his contemporaries. His teaching, it seems to me, is expressed in his life, the transcendence of the ego, that we must leave self behind. His moral teaching and social teaching is an expression of that, when he tells us to love our enemies. This is a way of our transcending our ego. When we are in enmity, you know, in hostility with others, it is our ego that is holding on to resentment or the desire to punish or to take revenge. And so the ego becomes caught in the cycle of violence. So Jesus is a teacher of nonviolence because he is a teacher of the transcendence of the ego. And his word for this is the kingdom. His mission was very simple. His teaching can be summarized in a few words. He said, the kingdom of heaven is close at hand. Now is the time to turn around, to turn your life around, to be converted and to enter the kingdom. And his concept of the kingdom, his idea of the kingdom, is central to his identity. The kingdom is not a place we are going to. The kingdom is not a reward that we have for being good. The kingdom is the reality of the presence of God. And where is it? He says on one occasion, you cannot observe when the kingdom of God will come. You cannot say, look, here it is or there it is, because in fact the kingdom of God, the kingdom of heaven, is within you. But this word that we translate as within can also be translated as among. So the kingdom is non-dualistic. It cannot be limited by space or time. So the kingdom is, in a sense, an experience that we enter into, an experience that transforms us. It's a transmission of consciousness. How do we enter the kingdom of God? That's his teaching. His teaching, I think the kingdom of God is parallel with the teaching of Nirvana. Maybe there are differences, but probably the best parallel is Nirvana. And how do we find Nirvana? How do we enter the kingdom of God, the kingdom of heaven? Well, that's the teaching. That's how he teaches us, by example and by word. By the example of his life, it was a life of engagement with his contemporary situation, with the politics, with the people, with the crisis of his time. He was not remote from his contemporaries. But he also took time to withdraw from active life, from speaking, from teaching. He would retire to solitary places to pray alone in the early hours of the morning or in company with his disciples. So for me, he is a model of how I should live my life. But to be a monk, for me, does not mean withdrawing completely away from the world, but also that I need time, my times of meditation, as all of us, but also I need time for silence, time for quiet, time to withdraw from activity. So for me, his life and the spirit of Jesus, which I'll come to in a minute, teaches me that. So I think at the first level, I relate to Jesus as a universal teacher, an exemplary human being who teaches by word, but also by example, a person of complete integrity, someone who has natural authority, someone who embodies the truth that I can trust completely. I have no skeptical questions. I'm open to any interpretation or question, but essentially, Jesus is someone in whom I can take refuge, as you take refuge in the Buddha. I can take refuge in Jesus with that childlike trust and complete confidence. And there is a second level of relationship for me to Jesus, which is where I feel that I am a disciple, not a very good disciple. I don't say that to be humble. I have a sense of what it means to be a disciple. I don't think I'm a very good disciple, but I do feel it is part of my identity to be a disciple. That's where my center of gravity is in my spiritual life. That relationship with Jesus, in whom I take refuge, straightens me out. And when I get my faults, my problems, my sinfulness, my mistakes, and so on, that center of gravity is faithful, is strong, and forgiving. And I feel it helps me to straighten myself out little by little. With this sense of being a disciple, with my center of gravity in this person of Jesus, I see that Jesus spoke at more than one level, that we can read his words at many levels, and we can interpret his life at many levels as well. The longer I live, the more I experience this connection or this sense that he is my center of gravity, the more mysterious is the person of Jesus. This leads to a third level of relationship, which is where we can begin to experience, in a small way, an awakening to the inner Christ. This is the essential mystery or the essential challenge, too, of Christian faith, that the historical person of Jesus, the universal teacher of wisdom, is also present in a way, in a form, within or with us. St. Paul says, the secret, the mystery, is Christ within you. And I think in the dialogue that we have shared over many years, I think the idea of the Buddha nature and the Christian idea that everyone is created in the image of God, those are parallel ideas, not exactly the same, but they are touching the same truth, that at the heart of the human person there is a capacity for infinite expansion, for liberation, for enlightenment, and in the Christian language we would say for divinization. So, for example, the theology that makes sense to me is a very ancient Christian theology, that God became human so that human beings became God. That is the destiny of the human being, that we are called to be divinized. What that means, it takes a long time to understand, perhaps. So there is an experience of awakening, continuous awakening, that I feel because of this center of gravity, because of the sense of taking refuge in Jesus. I have a feeling of an awakening to him and in him that occurs gradually, mysteriously, over time. Sometimes there are particular moments of insight when I think I understand it a little more. But the awakening is continuous, and it occurs within my life as I see what I feel to be in myself, Christ in me, I experience in others, in everyone I meet, whether it's the shoekeeper at the Buddhist temple that we went to in Varanasi a couple of days ago, the very humble people, the strangers you meet on the street, or in Your Holiness. I think Jesus, for me, means being able to recognize Him, or this mystery that He opens us to in the kingdom, in each other. When we really are open to each other at a human level, as you described, then this is what we see in the other person. And this reinforces what we see in ourselves. For me, the Gospels are very important. Every day, the Gospels teach me new things. I read the resurrection appearances with a sense that this is how we see or experience Jesus in the world. In the resurrection appearances after His death, we read in the Gospels that He just appeared. He just was there. He didn't come in a big flash of light or puff of smoke. He was there. When people first saw Him, they didn't recognize Him. But then, at some moment of awakening, they did see Him and recognized Him. And then He would disappear from their sight. But after He had disappeared from their sight, they felt empowered, energized, and they felt they had discovered their work, their mission, their responsibility in the world. So they were filled with an energy that sent them back to their life, to their work, with the feeling that He was accompanying them, that He was with them in this work. But it was their work. He wasn't taking responsibility away from them. He was giving them responsibility. He was empowering His disciples. And I think that, for me, is essential to understanding Jesus, that He doesn't just sit there wanting to be worshipped or venerated, because He always points away from Himself. In the Gospels, we see that. He points to the Father. At the Good Heart Seminar, an American sister asked you, Your Holiness, if you could meet Jesus and you could ask Him one question, what would you ask? Do you remember what?
Yes, yes.
And His Holiness said, immediately, I would ask Jesus, what is the nature of the Father? It was perfect, exactly the right question. And I think a lot of Christians would not have thought of that question, because we focus on Jesus, certainly, but Jesus does not focus on Himself. Jesus is focusing, turned towards the Father, the ultimate mystery, the ground of being, however we describe it. So to ask Jesus what is the nature of the Father is the crucial question. And it's what He wants, I think. That is why He taught, that's why He exists, that's why He was born, to bring us to that experience. So I try to explain something that's very difficult to explain in a way. When we speak about Jesus in our life, for many people today that sounds a bit strange, a bit weird. Somebody who died 2,000 years ago. But that is the essence of Christian faith. As you said, Your Holiness, we believe that life does not end with death. So the life of Jesus continues in a new way, with a new body, with a new consciousness. And this new body, this new life, this new consciousness, we call Christ, the Christ. For me, the connection between the historical Jesus and the inner Christ is the most interesting and mysterious and exciting connection in my life. And to feel that I am connected to that makes me feel connected to everything in this world. Through that connection, I can feel and love the truth in every religious tradition and in individuals, you know, who manifest the essence of that tradition. And I think that means that to be a Christian, for me, is a process. It's not just an identity, it's a process, it's an evolution. But it does mean, to be a Christian, that there is no competition. And Jesus did not compete with other religious leaders. So why should Christians compete or pretend to be superior to anyone else? That would be un-Christ-like. not like Jesus to do that. Historically, Christianity as a religion, because of its involvement in the political and economic empire that came out of the Western Hemisphere, Christianity as a religion often has become intolerant or exclusive. But that is being untrue to the way I understand Jesus at a personal level. Because if we draw a line between us and I say Jesus is here on my side of the line, as soon as I say that, he goes over to the other side. So any kind of exclusivism doesn't work. There was a great teacher of early Christian thought, Clement of Alexandria in the second century, who says that salvation is divinization. The meaning of salvation is that we become fully absorbed in the consciousness, the life of God. And that Jesus is a medicine, not a judge, but Jesus is a medicine or a physician that brings the healing to the world that we need in order to achieve our full human potential. So, those are some of my thoughts, a little vague maybe, who Jesus is for me, a teacher, a healer, and a way that through this connection with him and through the interior aspect of his presence, I feel I can live my life with a sense of meaning and a sense of service to others.
Wonderful, wonderful, really. Now, my own understanding about Christianity, I'm becoming much deeper. You really, through your own sort of experience, through your own sort of use, your intelligence, analyze, so you really develop deeper sort of understanding. Wonderful, wonderful.
In this session, we were going to take the theme of discipleship. The Buddhist expression for this is to take refuge in the teacher, guru, the master. Christians speak perhaps more often about following Jesus. And in the early part of the Gospels, we see Jesus gathering his disciples. And he gathers them by calling them. He says, "Come, follow me." And they respond in the stories by dropping their fishing nets or leaving their desks and immediately leave everything and follow him. And this ideal or image of discipleship is central to the Christian identity in some way, or Christian meaning. It is, of course, also universal. Particularly in the monastic tradition, the Desert Fathers, the early Christian monks, were hermits living in the desert. The monks would be in solitary practice, but disciples would come to them to learn from them, most of all by example. It was about living with your teacher. That was the most important way in which you learned. It wasn't so much about intellectual study or information, but seeing how your teacher responded to the situations of daily life or to moods and emotions and conflicts. So it was by example, sharing in the life of the teacher in a very simple, basic, domestic way. And then there was a kind of a contract between the disciple and the teacher. On the disciple's side, the disciple had to be completely open, completely trusting, and tell the truth, and say everything that he was going through. And on the master's, the teacher's, guru's side, he was faithful to the disciple. He would never abandon the disciple. So there's this contract of fidelity and truthfulness that made the teacher-disciple relationship. And this was seen as an expression of the relationship of the disciple to Jesus. The ultimate guru in the Christian vision is Jesus, although, of course, we have human gurus and visible gurus as well who can guide us in particular ways, but it is always the spirit of Christ, who is seen to be active in that person. And it was my own experience with John Main, for example. So in our human experience of discipleship, we discover why Jesus tells us, if you are to follow me, you must leave self behind, leaving our self-centeredness. And that was the call of Jesus. If you wish to follow me, leave self behind. And then he says in another passage, leave all your possession behind. Now that sounds very extreme and very dramatic, but that is the essence of discipleship. How we do that, of course, depends upon our calling in life, our vocation, our destiny, how we are meant to live. But it is a form of monastic renunciation to leave everything. I think this is what we do in meditation. At the time of meditation, we renounce everything. We were talking about emptiness at lunch. And although emptiness is a Buddhist term, sunyata, it is also a Christian concept in the idea of poverty of spirit. In meditation, by letting go of all the riches of our mind, imagination and thought and so on, we come to this experience where we are impermanent and where we are interdependent. And I think that is the essence of emptiness as well. So discipleship demands a radical renunciation. We may make that renunciation in different forms of life, but meditation is common to all those forms of life. And I think it takes us to the essence of discipleship. What is the bond that unites us to teachers in our lives? Do we need teachers? Do we need them throughout our life? Sometimes the guru appears in your life for a period and then is no longer there physically. But nevertheless, you would say they remain your teacher throughout your life. Then there are different kinds of teachers. There may be one fundamental teacher. For the Christian, that would be Jesus. For the Buddhist, that would be the Buddha. And then there are other teachers who have a formative influence, help to make us, form us, shape us, and those who make other, maybe less important contributions to our journey. It's a very unique and personal relationship. It carries with it a grace, an energy, a way of expanding our consciousness, which is deeply personal, that also transforms us and changes us. But it's a very sensitive relationship, and it has a great potential. If you think of the teachers you had at school or in your professional life, the relationship with a teacher can be a negative one also. The teacher has power over the student. And so, therefore, if the teacher cannot handle the intensity of the relationship can become non-productive, even corrupting, because of the ego. The ego can spoil or corrupt the relationship in two ways. It could be on the disciple's side. The disciple becomes possessive of his teacher, doesn't want to share his teacher with others, or becomes psychologically over-dependent on his or her teacher, so that they don't grow into full maturity. That would be on the disciple's side. On the teacher's side, the danger is that they are not able to use the power or the authority that they have and the projection that is an inevitable part of the teaching process. Projection from the student to the teacher. They put them on a pedestal and too high up and worship the teacher and so on. And the teacher can take this too literally and abuse the relationship or the power. So I think if we speak about this relationship, we have to be very honest that it can be very powerful and liberating and empowering. It can bring the disciple into maturity. But it can also go wrong if there isn't a sufficient maturity in the teacher. So discipleship is a liberating and a fulfilling human relationship that brings the disciple into the fullness of their potential. Jesus says, it is enough for a disciple to be like his teacher. And yet he also says to his disciples before he leaves them, he says, you will do greater things than me. And that seems to me to be why we can trust Jesus as a teacher, because he doesn't try to possess the power that he has or possess his disciples. You know, a good teacher is happy if the student fulfills his potential and may do greater things than the teacher. A good teacher is happy about that. And I think Jesus is a good teacher for that very reason. He sees that the accumulation of experience and energy within the Christian community of disciples produces greater things than he was able to do in his own lifetime. The question is about discipleship in the modern world. In the ancient world and in the traditional religions, this relationship was seen as a special grace, perhaps, but also something central to the idea of spiritual growth and formation. It was a fast track to maturity and to individuation, provided that the connection between the disciple and the teacher, it was in a healthy place in the disciple and in the teacher. So I think we're very conscious today of the psychological dimension of this relationship and of the danger of unhealthy connections. But the other question is, does modern culture and modern sense of individual worth and individual dignity and so on, how does that relate to the traditional idea of following a teacher? I think it's much more challenging for modern people, certainly modern secular people, to understand the nature of this relationship. Perhaps there is a greater awareness today of the need for the disciple to be committed to personal maturity, personal responsibility, and personal practice, and not to be dependent psychologically on the teacher. And also the social structures are very different. But I still think that this is still a relationship of grace that is universal and always present. And we have to be able to recognize in the circumstances of our own lives where these relationships exist. We are then responsible for how we take that opportunity, because no good teacher is going to force himself or herself onto the disciple. They may give the invitation, come, follow me, or open the opportunity, but then today especially, where we are aware of the power of choice in coming to maturity, it's up to us to respond. Discipleship means a deep listening, and listening is the basis of obedience. So the word obedience in English comes from the Latin word ob audire, which means to listen. So to be obedient is to listen. The word disciple comes from the Latin dicere, which means to learn. So we're learning by a deep listening. And the essence of discipleship is, I think, a certain kind of spiritual friendship, not the domination of one person over another. But in friendship, there has to be a fundamental equality, that relationship that His Holiness was talking about at the beginning of the session this morning, of just one human being to another. Although the differences between those two human beings may be very great, they are fundamentally equal in their humanity. This relationship, as it develops in its own unique way over time, maybe a short time or maybe many years, this relationship, I think, has an effect both upon the disciple and upon the teacher. The disciple experiences it as a healing and an empowerment and a liberation from fear, because in the relationship, the disciple is turned towards the teacher to listen in a deep and obedient way, and to serve. Again, this question of service has to be understood in the modern psychological sense, but that is the role of the disciple. is to find their own empowerment and maturity in a spirit of service. And the relationship provides the opportunity for that. We see it in other forms of education, sitting at the feet of a good professor, going to their classes, and, you know, the students of that professor will be very happy to be of service in the class or in preparatory work or in research. But at the spiritual level, the service goes deeper and may take other forms. Discipleship is not about belonging to a sect. The corrupt form or false form of discipleship is one that gathers around a teacher but becomes a kind of a closed circle that is inward looking. But what we see in both in the Buddha and in Jesus calling their disciples to them and training them and giving them the example of how to live, we see a community forming that is turned outwards to the benefit of the world, not just to the benefit of the Sangha or the community of disciples. And that's, I think, one of the real tests of true discipleship, that it produces through the love and fidelity and obedience to the teacher, it produces people who are turned outwards in a spirit of service to the world at large. Community is essential to discipleship. Although the relationship between the teacher and the disciple is a deeply intimate and personal one, it happens within community, strangely enough. And this, I think, also helps to ensure the health of the relationship. It keeps the center of the relationship away from the ego, the possessiveness or the tendency of the ego to try to control. In my own experience with Father John, he was a strong teacher with a very clear vision and strong personality, but I don't think he ever told me what to do. Many times when I was in doubt or confused about various questions or things I should do or not do, I could discuss them with him, but he would never say, well, this is what you've got to do. But after the conversation, it would be very clear to me what I should do. And then I would hopefully do it. That's a certain quality of a true teacher, I think, to help to bring the disciple to their own clarity and then empower them to make their own choice. That takes place both within the intimacy of the friendship, but also within the community. Those are some of the elements of discipleship as I see them from my own experience and in the Christian tradition. I think modern culture is challenging to this, largely because our idea of ourself, of our personality, of what the self is, has changed, but also because in the modern world we have become much more atomized, much more individualistic. As a result of that, the ego structure in modern culture is very strong in one sense, but very weak in another sense. It's very strong in the sense that our ego is developed through materialism and consumerism to be very self-centered, but very weak in that it makes it difficult for us to transcend. It takes a certain strength in the ego, certain kind of strength in the ego, to transcend itself. And that's what the relationship of discipleship to the teacher allows, this transcendence to take place, as it does in meditation. This is why we need teachers of meditation. Nobody would begin to meditate without the example of others. The teacher, it seems to me, is an integral part of the spiritual journey and a wonderful grace and gift in our lives. An opportunity, when it comes, we should be able to recognize it and embrace it. And it's something, I think, that meditation prepares us for. People begin to meditate today for many different reasons: to restore their hair, to improve their cholesterol, to cope with stress and so on. And that's a perfectly valid way to begin, or motivation to begin. But I think once you've begun to feel the physical or psychological benefits of meditation, you also begin to discover there is a spiritual dimension to your being. And at this point in your development, and this point in your journey of meditation, a teacher becomes very valuable and will appear in some form at the right time, in the right way. Apart from the individual teacher, which is, I've been concentrating upon that, but apart from the individual teacher, which is a special grace, I think there are other ways in which we can experience discipleship through community, through the weekly meditation group. Your Holiness, we have weekly meditation groups that meet in churches, in schools, in universities, in parishes, in all sorts of places of work. And I think the group develops a friendship through the practice of meditation together. Many of you are parts of meditation groups. I think that becomes a teacher. Let's say we experience the Spirit, who is the teacher. Jesus tells us that he will continue to teach us through the Spirit. The Spirit will be your teacher, he says, after I have gone. So we can experience the teacher, the Spirit, through the meditation group, and of course, through the scriptures, and through any form of human activity, of art or music or science, which manifests the truth. So the central relationship with one's teacher is the guiding light through the different phases of one's life. Can I ask you one question? I know there are different philosophical Buddhist positions on where is the Buddha now, or what is the influence of the Buddha now. Do you feel personally the presence of the Buddha?
Oh, yes.
The same historical figure in a new form?
No, not necessarily historical figure, but I don't know what you say, Buddha's spirit soul. Sure. Oh, in other words, Buddha, different form.
Yes.
So Buddha is not just the physical.
So Buddha is not just limited to the physicality.
No. So Buddha's still alive. Buddha's still there. And number of cases is actually seeing Buddha and receive some teaching. Also is possible. Recently, I was told one Thai monk, he actually, you see, received vision of Buddha. So since then, you see, he accepted Buddha's spirit or Buddha's being still there. Some Buddhist school of thought, when Buddha passed away, then Buddha's mind no longer there.
Yeah.
Those schools actually believe that there is an end to the continuity of consciousness. Now there are four major different schools of thought in Buddhist tradition. So one school of thought, even there, I think subdivision, 18 divisions. So some, you see, believe at the time of Buddha's death, Buddha's mind no longer there. But the rest of the Buddhist school of thought, you see, believe Buddha's mind still there and Buddha's being still there.
So that would be similar, essentially the same as the Christian understanding that Jesus died physically, because he was a human being, so he had to die, but his consciousness continued.
Consciousness, or I think beings, Lavina.
Jesus as a being.
As I mentioned, if you use Buddha's mind, then you get impression, only mind, no.
Yeah, I see.
So Buddha's being means complete. It's a different form of body, or sometimes it's a formless body. So Jesus Christ, he's sort of human physical, dead, passed away, but his being still there. So the blessing, and through meditation, through certain sort of experience, you can get interaction with
him. Very similar. Very similar.
I think the Buddhist explanation, our sensorial consciousness, based on body. This is real, the brain, related with brain. So brain of this physical. Now those consciousness not heavily depend on physical. Like dream, sometimes special dream body. Some cases dream body can depart, can separate from this body. So that mind not depend on physical, grosser sort of physical sort of faculty. Mm. So therefore, sometimes the greater chance see a Buddhist being or Jesus Christ being.
The Christian would believe that the continuation of the being of Jesus is a presence that is active.
Yes.
In some way, and if we collaborate with it, or if we open ourselves to this being in his new form, that our lives are changed, transformed.
Oh, yes.
Our minds are changed.
That's right.
By that.
That's right.
So there is an active, subtle, of course very subtle, but an active influence of the presence of Jesus. You would say the same is true of the Buddha?
Oh, yes. Actually, the very purpose of appearance of Jesus is benefit or helping to sentient being.
So the Buddhist explanation would be if there's the particular sentient beings, karma is ripened.
That means his or her own mental attitude become sort of
receptive.
Or receptive. No. Then you can see. Mm. So similarly, I think the very purpose of appearance of Jesus Christ is not only serving during his own generation. I think, frankly speaking, during his own sort of lifetime, Jesus may not be so popular. After him, you see millions and millions of followers there. So his energy with his sort of being among his followers, you see mentally something receptive, then certainly see some special blessing or some special sort of connection.
So we would say, although his physical body died, he still has a body in different
subtle
realms,
subtle level.
In subtle ways.
Yes,
both in his followers, but in another sense, with the cosmos, with the whole material world.
That we can say.
In Christian language, we would say Jesus died, he ascended. He went into this other realm and he returned to the Father. Mm. And he became reintegrated with the Father. So the Buddha's parallel to this.
There is a
parallel.
So from the point of view of Sanskrit tradition of Buddhism, we could also say that the Nirmanakaya form of Buddha, in which the Buddha Shakyamuni appeared, finally dissolves into the Sambhogakaya form of Buddha.
Well, then that means Buddha appears solid body. So Sambhogakaya, body, but not this solid body. So solid body, this beginning, and birth and death. The more subtle body just manifests from deeper Tamagaya.
Yes.
Like that.
You can hear more talks and conversations in the media section on our website, WCCM.org, or in your favorite podcast player. Thanks for listening for WCCM. I am Elba Rodriguez.